From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. When it comes to addressing environmental issues, plastic pollution is one of the worst. In fact, according to a 2021 report from the Last Beach Cleanup and Beyond Plastics, more than 90% of the United States plastic waste ended up in a landfill, an ocean, or an incinerator. And as the pollution from single-use plastics continues to rise, the problem isn't getting any smaller. This is why Dr. Ruth J.B. will be taking a look at how the U.S. and other countries are responding to the crisis next week at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, and she's joining us now. I want to welcome you to the program.
Thank you so much, Gemma. Thanks for having me.
So can you just talk to us a little bit about truly how big is the plastic problem around the world?
Oh, it's enormous, and it has multiple different aspects, Gemma. I think that's what's so challenging about it. We tend to think of an environmental problem just on the basis of what exists right now, but of course, we produce tons of plastic every single year, and in fact, plastic production is increasing, so we're making more plastic and making more plastic stuff, even as we sort of don't know how to get rid of and how to deal with the plastic that we already have. So all countries are experiencing issues with plastic, but certainly if you're in a developed economy where so much of our lifestyle depends on stuff that is plastic or has plastic in it, the problems are escalating all the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so can we talk a little bit more about that? Because yeah. I just think about my own plastic use in my own house. And I'm aware of the problem, and yep. I try to reduce my plastic use. But I mean, I think about things like just washing my hair today, for example. Yep. My shampoo and conditioner comes in plastic containers. And, you know, that's just one example. We have glass bowls that we use to put, you know, food leftovers and all of that. We made that switch years ago. However, I do still have like some plastic containers because I don't want to send glass to school in my kids' lunch, right? So I'm just thinking about my plastic bags for the garbage. I mean, I'm literally thinking of my own plastics use, and yep. it's probably bigger than I think it is. So what do we do as consumers, I guess?
I think your puzzlement over this is not uncommon. Once you really start to unpack your own lifestyle, and part of it is like, look in your recycling container and look at how much of it is plastic. But even beyond that, if you wear eyeglasses, you've got plastic. If you wear contact lenses, our clothing, if you wear polyester clothing, that's got plastic in it. So plastic has become so deeply embedded in our lifestyles that it can become really challenging to figure out where's that loose thread in my lifestyle that I can start to pull. I think one of the other things that happens is dealing with plastic waste is really part of a very kind of large system. And there are some things that consumers can do. Recycle what you can recycle. Eliminate plastic when you can eliminate it. Sort of, you know, take your reusable bags to the grocery store. Do what you can do. But I think the reality of it is that consumer behavior cannot solve this whole problem. Because by the time plastic gets to you, there are so many of those impacts already embedded in it, you can't undo all of that yourself. So it's going to take something more than just people mm-hmm. throwing more stuff into the blue recycling bin to really adequately deal with the issues.
Okay, I really appreciate you saying that it's not consumers that can just fix the problem, because a lot of times it feels as if, you know, we are like the consumers are the problem. That's how we feel, and there's guilt
yeah.
around that.
And I was going to say, it's like, there obviously are some players in the plastic story that would love for consumers to feel really guilty about their plastic use and kind of take the whole weight of this on their shoulders. I think that's absolutely not accurate. So, you know, to your listeners, don't feel guilty, because you aren't the ones who are creating this problem. There's some stuff you can do, but there are other players that have to do stuff as well.
Okay, so with that said, let's talk history here. Because you have looked at how fast the use of plastics has grown just since 1950. If you can kind of explain that history to us, but then also, is it a fair statement to say that this has been an explosive growth of plastics use.
Absolutely, it is. So, you know, people, and this is mostly chemists, started messing around with playing with these different polymers, which are just chemicals. They're strings of chemicals. That's what plastic is made out of. And they're all distilled from oil. So the problem starts with the raw material here, which is it's made out of oil. But we started messing around with that in the early part of the 20th century. And then post-World War II into the 50s, the chemists started to really get the chemistry down. And to figure out how can we stabilize those strings of polymers? How can we commercialize them? And so you're absolutely right, I think, in characterizing this as explosive. The use of plastic, if you look at it on a graph, just goes like, I mean, it just skyrockets in about the mid to late 1950s. And of course, once we've got good at making different kinds of plastics, we started to see more and more ways that we could use them. So it's not just food containers and it's not just plastic bags. It's your contact lenses, it's clothing, it's your backpacks, it's your Barbie dolls, it's in almost everything. It's in insulation in houses. So we actually got incredibly inventive at thinking about how to leverage plastic for a whole variety of different uses. And that has a lot of what has led to the escalation in the use of plastic. It's actually a material that's good at doing a lot of things. And we took that ball and just ran with it.
So when plastic was invented, what was the hope or the goal of plastic?
You know, I'm not sure that the inventors, that's such a great question, really sort of had a specific idea in mind, but I'm going to guess that the early chemists, so if you think about what is plastic really good at, well, number one, it lasts a long time. It doesn't degrade very quickly. Number two, it's really lightweight. And so if you think about those two functionalities, there's, you can see the whole variety of different ways to actually use plastic. So think about as a food container, for example. It's awesome as a food container because the food doesn't usually interact with the plastic. It keeps it really nice and fresh. It does a great job. If you think about how lightweight plastic is, that's why it's used in cars, for example, in automobiles. Mm. It makes them lighter. It makes them more fuel efficient. So I think the early originators of plastic started to see those characteristics and then carried that forward to, well, where are the ways in our lives that we actually want those things? We want to keep things fresh. We want to make things lighter. We want things to last longer. So plastic has some properties that are so positive that I think it wasn't very challenging to figure out how to use it.
So then it seems that, you know, so here we are in the 1950s and then in the 60s, the 70s, 80s, people were using plastic. There was I don't remember conversations when I was a kid about plastic. But it seemed to be what about the mid to late 90s when all of a sudden we started hearing conversations about some concerns around plastic. And does this go back to this discovery of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch? And first, can you tell us what that is? But is that kind of what started this conversation?
I think that's what really brought it into the public's mind. There actually had been environmental activists in the mid to late 1970s who started to look at the condition of the ocean and tried to bring this to the forefront. But I think it was the discovery of what's called now the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is just this huge sort of, we think of it as a floating island. It's actually not like an island, but it is this large accumulation of plastic in the Pacific Ocean. And the plastic there has largely been brought together by ocean currents and waves and things like that, that have just created this huge kind of patch. And once sailors found that in the 1970s, and a journalist started to actually write about it and publicize it, publish pictures of it, I think that really brought the issue of plastic waste and plastic pollution to the forefront of the public's mind. And I think it really started to cause some people to think about plastic as a key environmental issue.
So I want to talk a little bit more now about the United States and other countries. And this goes to the fact that we have historically for years dumped our plastic trash in China. So then China stopped importing all of that waste. So first off, when did that stop? But then what was the impact, the effect of plastic waste worldwide once China said, you know, no more?
That's such a great question. It's such a complex phenomenon, Gemma, but I think it is the key to what's happening in most of the way that the world looks at plastic now. So the change in China's trade policies actually came in about 2017 and 2018. And they had really decided, listen, we've kind of, you know, imported enough of your plastic garbage over the years. We don't want it anymore. And China had been the single largest importer of plastic waste from all countries all over the world up to that point. So, mm-hmm. of course, imagine the ripple effect of them saying we aren't going to take, really aren't going to take in anymore. And what that meant for countries like the United States and for a lot of European countries is that we had to figure out what to do with all of that plastic stuff. Now, we couldn't just put it on a ship and send it to China. And we'd really outsourced our plastic waste because it was less expensive than developing our own domestic recycling infrastructure, for example. Mm. So what really happened, Gemma, is we've got all this plastic waste now that can't get shipped to China. Cities are trying to figure out, what do I do with all this stuff that I'm collecting through my recycling programs? I don't have a recycling plant to actually do anything with it, because what we called recyclers in the United States were really just sort of through passes to get stuff to China. So cities started to burn the plastic waste in an incinerator or buried in a landfill. And it was largely because we had no incentive to actually develop real recycling infrastructure in this country as long as we could ship stuff off to China.
What was China doing with all the plastics that was being shipped their way?
So China was really using the plastic in a couple of different ways. China started to take plastic in as they were trying to build their own manufacturing and their own industrial sort of economy. And so they needed raw materials. You need raw materials to make stuff, to manufacture stuff. And they developed processes to actually use the plastic that was getting sent into the country to integrate it into its own products and to integrate it into its own manufacturing. But by the mid 2010s or so, China had figured out how to generate its own raw materials. So it didn't need to import that plastic from other countries. It could supply its own raw material needs.
So you mentioned how now, you know, cities all across the world and countries are trying to figure out what to do with their plastics, right? Because they didn't build this infrastructure. And,
right.
And we've seen this right here in Idaho, in Boise in particular, like a few years back, it was all of a sudden like, we're going to add this element of recycling. We're going to give you these orange bags, and you put certain, plastics in this orange bag, put it on top of your recycling. And then that orange bag is going to be taken to Utah, where they're going to be able to, I don't know if they were incinerating it, but they have a recycling area for it. That never got up and running because there were issues with the recycling process. So is this something, I'm definitely, you know, abbreviating that whole story, but I mean, that's basically the gist of it.
Yep.
Is that what a lot of cities, not just in the US, but across the world are running into, is this lack of infrastructure to be able to handle plastic waste?
Yeah. So part of it is the lack of infrastructure, because again, recycling is a physical process, right? So if you haven't actually built the facilities to do the physical remake of plastic, then you aren't going to be able to recycle it. So there is that part of it. But another really important part of it, I think, Gemma, is the economics of recycling. So this is another place where I think what consumers know and what the industry knows are two completely different things. Before I started doing this research, I had this picture in my head of recycling that was kind of like a big fondue pot, and you just threw all your plastics into it and they kind of melted it down and they just made some new plastic stuff out of it. And that seemed like a pretty simple process, but that is not how plastic recycling works at all. So your listeners might be aware of the Chasing Symbols logo, right? That little triangular logo with that number in it, number one, number two. And I think most consumers think that Chasing Arrow symbol means something is recyclable. In fact, it doesn't mean that at all. There are multitudes, hundreds and thousands of different types of plastic. They're all different chemical formulas. And all of those different types of plastic have to be recycled separately. So the plastic number ones have to be separated from the number twos, from the number threes, from the number fours, because you can't just melt it all down together. And that makes it the economics of recycling really complicated, because once you start to have to sort stuff into different piles, there are labor costs. Someone has to physically do that. But it also means that you're going to end up with smaller piles of stuff to actually reuse. And that means you've incurred costs without having the right volume of plastic to make new stuff out of it. So one of the challenges we have is that we have so many different kinds of plastic that it starts to undercut the value of recycling by making it more expensive to do it.
Okay, so with that said then, it doesn't seem to me that if that's the case, anything will change unless we have maybe laws surrounding what we, you know, how we recycle or this entire industry. And I know that you've looked at the laws that states and the federal government have considered when it comes to plastic waste. So is there any consensus on who should be responsible for regulating this issue? And I guess top down, does the plastics industry even want this stuff to be recycled?
That's two really interesting questions. So let me start with the industry question first. I think there's some evidence that the plastic industry is really playing kind of both sides of this game. Let's put it that way. The plastics industry wants to keep making plastic because that's how they make their money. But they have done some investment in owning recycling facilities. Now, that doesn't mean they necessarily want more recycling, but it does mean that they're getting revenue coming from both sides of this waste stream, right? They're getting it from making the plastic, and then they're getting it from recycling the plastic. So in some ways, they may not care that much. I think the other question is, what do we do to actually try to change this system? Because this is a system with lots of different pieces, and it's really complex, and it's global. You can't regulate plastic effectively on a country-by-country basis because the supply chains are all global. So one of the things that's being talked about now at the UN, the UN is actually sponsoring negotiations to try to come up with a global plastics treaty. And one of the measures that some countries are advocating is that we need to simplify the number of plastics that we have. We need to come down to sort of a core, much smaller number of plastic formulas so that we don't have this economic problem with recycling. And we would decide on what those are globally, so that again, a plastic that's made in one country could be recycled in another country without having to move plastic around a lot. So there is some movement to try to simplify the world of plastic and make it easier to both physically and economically do the recycling.
So it would seem then that in order for this to be successful, what you just laid out, what the UN is doing, is maybe the only way that we see progress in plastics waste.
I think that is kind of my view. I think it's incredibly difficult to try to continue to regulate this on a country by country by country level. Because if I'm making a plastic off a certain formula in the United States, but I'm shipping that product to Canada, and their recycling system can't even recognize that formula, that just creates a situation where we'll never get out of this endless cycle of waste. So I think there has to be some global regulation at the global level, simply because we move plastic around through global supply chains and global trade chains. And so we've got to regulate it at that level.
So then it goes back to this idea that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation today, where there is this messaging going on that it's the consumer's problem. It's the consumer's fault. We are the problem. Yep. We are using too much plastic, right? We are being wasteful and we don't care about the earth, right? And so you need to recycle and you need to use less plastic. But it seems to me that what you've just laid out for us is the problem truly is bigger than any one of us. And so it seems that we, and we meaning the world, global leaders, need to figure out a way to reduce what we produce.
And it's really, I think that's a really good point. There is a group of countries at these UN negotiations that are saying, listen, the plastic problem starts at the point where we produce plastic. And we've got to look at actually capping our production of plastic. And that means we have to look at developing substitute materials, but they really go back to square one. This is also a group of countries that recognizes there's a link between the production of plastic and climate change. Plastic is made out of oil. So all of the problems that we have with fossil fuels, again, are part of the plastic problem and get embedded in plastic. And for those reasons, they say, listen, we have to start to cap production and start to move ourselves to different types of materials. As you can imagine, there are countries that disagree pretty vehemently with that position. But I think it's a conversation that consumers need to be aware of too, that plastics problems are really deeply embedded in the material itself. And just trying to recycle is never going to undo all of those problems.
So bottom line for you, where should the bulk of change come from?
So I'm really am a believer that we are past the point where voluntary activity is going to effectively deal with our plastic problem. It just isn't. And I also don't think that, you know, local or state regulation is going to be enough to deal with the problem either. So I have really become kind of firmly convinced that we need this global treaty, whatever its provisions are, to actually try to incentivize countries to confront the realities of plastic as part of our lifestyle and make the really sort of deep and broad changes that need to be made. So I would say, you know, consumers, keep recycling what you can recycle. But if you really are concerned about this issue, get on the phone or get on the horn to your legislators and push the United States to become serious about these global negotiations. I think that is where our effort needs to go.
I want to thank you so much for this conversation. I have to say I've learned a lot and I really appreciate this perspective. So thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Great. Thank you very much, Gemma. Happy to talk with you.
We've been speaking with Dr. Ruth Jabe about the global regulation of plastic. She'll be speaking more on this topic. It'll be next week, March 27th, at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute in Boise. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.